Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason. Today is a throwback episode. We're talking with Ari Schneider, who this was one of the first episodes I edited, so please know I've gotten a lot better since this one came out, but this was back in December 2018, episode 432. Kurt is interviewing Ari, that's the previous host, if you don't remember. And this was just a great episode talking about how alpine climbing and being up in the mountains is so healing for us. And Ari's going to get into a story, and that's just something time and time again we hear and we know is true. Heck, I just heard someone yesterday that I didn't think was much of an outdoor person said that's their place of healing. And it just went to show me and even confirm me even more that no matter who you are, where you go to school or work or where you live, no matter who you are, if you're a human being, the outdoors and nature and being out in it more often than you probably are right now is good for you. It's good for us. It's good for the soul. It's good for the mind, the body. Very little downsides, unless, you know, it's a lightning storm or something. But, you know, take your just be cautious. Anyway, before we jump in, I wanted to give you a reminder that we do have the Adventure Grant applications open right now till February 22nd, and then we're going to select winners by March 7th. Don't wait. If you want to get one of our grants, we're giving away $1,750 and a ton of gear. Apply. We're looking for adventures happening this year. You get to be a guest on the show. It's going to be awesome. So many of our past guests have come from applicants from previous years' adventure grants. So if you know somebody that's doing an adventure this year, or you're doing one yourself, please apply. The link is in the show notes. We cannot wait to see what kind of stories come in. All right, let's go ahead and jump into Ari's story.
Hello and welcome again to the Adventure Sports Podcast. This is your host, Kurt Linville. I have Ari Schneider on the line today, and he has a fun story to tell as well as a book to tell you about. After his junior year at university, Ari felt the need to take a kind of an extensive adventure trip. And out of that trip came a lot of, introspection and self-discovery. And he wrote a book about it. And we're going to be talking about the book today. Where the Wind Heals is the name of the book. And so, Ari, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Sure, man. So you mentioned that you are a climber, you're a backcountry skier, and an outdoor educator. So you've been teaching climbing and skiing for a while.
Yeah, so I've been an athlete for about a decade now, and it started when I was in high school. I was a competitive freestyle skier. And so after I graduated, I took a job coaching for the same program that I came out of, and I was coaching strength and conditioning, as well as on hill training for freestyle skiers. And then through college, I actually taught outdoor education classes at Tufts University, which was where I really fell in love with outdoor education. Graduated and went on to take some courses through the American Mountain Guides Association, get a wilderness first responder, all that sort of stuff. And I haven't been actively teaching recently, but I have been incorporating my background in outdoor ed into a lot of my writing. Actually, last year I came out with a book called Outdoor Leadership in Education, which was based on an outdoor leadership class I taught at Tufts University a few years ago.
So another book, Outdoor Leadership. Say it again.
Outdoor Leadership and Education.
And education.
Yeah, and it's just a short little, I think it's about 90 pages, short little book. And it's just based off the curriculum for an outdoor leadership class I taught.
Very cool. Well, we actually, it's kind of like our life experiences cross in some strange ways here. And let me explain why I mean by that. First of all, my wife's maiden name is Schneider. So we're probably related by marriage somehow in some distant, you know, way. Who knows, right? So that's a fun one. But another one is that my two older children both went through an outdoor leadership program their junior year in high school, and they got dual enrollment credit, college credit, for doing that, in which they were trained in outdoor leadership, and now you're the writer of the book for it, so that's pretty cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
I want to get to the, I guess, the story that is the book, and it all starts back at Tufts University around the time you were finishing up your junior year, and take us there. Tell us what the motivation was for this trip and what was going on in your world.
Yeah, so last week I just released a book that I've been working on for the past couple of years that is called Where the Wind Heals, and it's based on a road trip I took from Boston to the north coast of Alaska with my best friend. And that all started back my junior year in college. I was definitely going through a rough patch. I had some relationship troubles with my girlfriend at the time, and we ended up breaking up. I was pretty sad, and I just needed to run away. And my best friend also felt like he needed to run away at the time too. And so we packed up my small little Subaru Impreza. We built a wooden platform on the back, in the back seat, just kind of crammed it in there. Zephyr, my best friend at the time, and he's still my best friend, we crammed it in the back seat with all of our stuff. We slept back there, and ended up driving all the way up to the north coast of Alaska. And we stopped and tried to climb as many of the beautiful mountains that we encountered along the way.
Cool. So the, I guess the reason for the trip was you just felt the need to escape what was going on a little bit and have a new experience. You know, you hear that quite a bit. People just get fed up with the way things have been going, and they're like, I have to just clear my head. So was that, am I right that was really the driver behind this?
Well, I think that's a big part of it. If I had been totally happy in Boston at the time, I might have still gone on this trip. But I think my mindset at the time really shaped how the trip ended up. And Zephyr and I, we're very adventurous people. We're the kind of people that would just be sitting in a living room one day, say, hey, I wonder how far away from here we can drive. And then a few weeks later, just get in the car and do it. But this is also an escape for us. And we both needed to get out of Boston. And it wasn't, I think being at college, university was not a very healthy place for me. And I think for a lot of people, that's the case. So getting out into the wilderness just seemed like the most logical escape, and driving somewhere that is actually as far away from Boston as you can possibly drive. at first we thought, hey, maybe we'll drive to South America, but it turns out there's this thing called the Darien Gap,
right?
100 miles of wilderness, so you have to take a ferry around it, and we thought taking a ferry would be cheating, so we drove to the north coast of Alaska instead.
Oh, that's fun. So when you say north coast of Alaska, where, I mean, Alaska's a big place, where did you end up?
Yeah, Prudhoe Bay. So once you hit Fairbanks, that's the start of something called the Dalton Highway. And it's really just an access highway to the North Slope, where they're doing a lot of drilling for oil. And you get up to Prudhoe Bay, which is on the north coast of Alaska, and you actually can't quite get to the north coast because it's all run by oil companies. There's a lot of red tape. And so you do need to pay a lot of money to get on a bus, which tourists do, to actually go up and touch the coast. But I think Zephyr and I stopped just at the end of the highway. We figured that was close enough.
Okay. So from where you were, could you see the Arctic Ocean?
Yeah, we could. And we could see a lot of tundra and a lot of oil rigs. It definitely was not the most beautiful scenery. And I will admit, Zephyr and I took no photos from the north coast of Alaska. And actually, we took one, and it was a photo of the gas prices up there, which I believe were almost $6 a gallon, which I think is kind of ironic because that's where they're drilling for the oil. But of course, it needs to get shipped down the pipeline and then refined and brought all the way back up. But I joke about this in my book. I say something like that apples ought to be cheaper on the orchard.
Yeah, I agreed. You know, the funny thing, though, I don't know that I've ever seen pictures of Prudhoe Bay. I think almost everybody knows what Prudhoe Bay is because it's been such a political hotspot. But, you know, I don't know that I've ever seen it. I have no idea what it looks like.
Yeah, it's definitely not the most beautiful place on Earth. It's a lot of tundra. And but when you drive up that Dalton Highway, you go through so many environments, and that was just spectacular. Everything from really densely forested areas through tundra, through flat areas, and the mountainous Brooks Range, which were absolutely incredible. And so you see a lot, and including wildlife, muskox, grizzly bear, just on the side of the road.
Neat stuff. So just for context, quickly tell us the gist of what your route was from Boston to get up there.
Yeah, so the first place we stopped was in Denver, Colorado. And that was because Zephyr at the time was dating somebody who graduated from Tufts the year before him. And she lived with her family in Denver. So we stopped there to visit her. And we climbed a little bit around the area. We climbed on the Flatirons, which was a lot of fun. And from there, we just headed north into the Canadian Rockies, spent some time in Canmore, Alberta. We stopped in the Bugaboos, and then continued up through British Columbia, through the Yukon, and up Alaska to Prudhoe Bay. And actually, after we hit the north coast of Alaska, we turned around, went south. And Zephyr's family is actually from Sitka, which is in southeast Alaska. It's on Baranof Island. So we drove down. You actually have to drive out of Alaska back through Canada to get to southeast Alaska. And we took a ferry from Haines, Alaska to Sitka, where Zephyr grew up. And I spent about a month with his family there.
Oh, man, sounds like a great trip. And I kind of did the opposite of that trip when I was 17. I went from Vancouver across to Maine and down to Boston. So anyway, it's kind of funny that way too. I guess what I would like to get into, there's so many things that pop up here. First of all, did you plan the trip out to be okay, we're going to go here and climb this. We're going to go there and try to climb that. We're going to go here and do this. Or was it more a matter of, we're going to go, man?
Oh, it was a matter of we're going to go. We had very little plan. And I joke about this in the book. We packed everything but the kitchen sink. My Subaru was just really overflowing. There was a pretty hilarious picture that went around the internet for a while of us unpacking all the stuff and just laying it out in the parking lot. And we, besides from knowing we wanted to go through the Canadian Rockies and knowing we wanted to end up in Prudhoe Bay and then go and visit Zephyr's family in southeast Alaska, we had almost no plan, and we just kind of followed where the good weather was, climbed some things here and there. And Zephyr and I are both very avid climbers. We've been doing it for a while. And we specialize more in kind of adventure, alpine climbing. We're definitely not athletic sport climbers by any means. So we were just kind of looking for beautiful, fun, adventurous mountains to scramble around on.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
Man, I hear you there. I love that. I love that. That exploring mountains. And when I say exploring, I have to be walking and hiking. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But exploring mountains is one of my favorite things ever. So another funny connection here is I accidentally climbed the first Flatiron. How did you guys climb it?
Well, kind of almost in a similar fashion. We, the first Flatiron, it's not known as being a particularly difficult rock climb. It's filled with a lot of very well, established routes, a lot of easy ways up the Flatiron. People free solo the thing every day. And so Zephyr and I just kind of showed up at the bottom of the thing. Like, we didn't even plan which route we were going to go up. And, I think what we did want to climb, there was a long line of people to get on it. So we just decided, hell, we're going to just go up this way, whatever. And so we started meandering up and ended up very far off of anything. I think that was a climbing route, and the rock started getting crumbly, and there was really no place to put any protection. And so we definitely found a convoluted way up to the top, which is exactly what Zephyr and I were in the business of doing. It's just kind of looking for convoluted adventure, and that's what we love. That's what I'm in love with as an outdoors person.
That's funny. Your description and mine would be very similar. The thing about the first Flatiron is that if you were to fall, it's not really fall. It's a tumble for hundreds of feet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's steep enough that you can't just stop on it. But it's tempting because you think, oh, I can almost get up that without having to be technical. But then you find out you have some pretty extreme exposure up there.
Right. And the reason I included that as a chapter in the book was actually because once we got to the top, we got caught in a pretty bad lightning storm, which is classic for Colorado. And I have a history of getting stuck in lightning storms. And I definitely had a little bit of a flashback to a few years prior. I was in the Alps. I was on a hiking trip in the Alps and ended up just getting caught in this freak storm and had to spend 2 hours just in lightning position. And now I hear that rumble, I always kind of flash back to that. And so I discuss that kind of feeling when I'm up there in on the Flatiron. It's just I'm not very far from Boulder at all. It's not like I'm way out in the wilderness, but it can feel, you know, kind of isolating once that thunder rolls in, to have that little trigger point.
Yeah, no doubt, man. I hear you. So here at the Adventure Sports Podcast, we're always promoting adventure and safety. And but at the same time, we love the stories about when things didn't go as planned. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're great learning opportunities. And that's, you know, as an outdoor educator, I've written extensively on risk management and decision-making processes. And I like to think I make very good decisions in the Alpine, but the Alpine's also a dangerous place, and things happen, and weather, we can't control weather. So sometimes things happen, and when you walk away, they're always great learning opportunities.
Oh, yeah. Well, as far as the first Flatiron goes, my buddy and I made it to the top. We really didn't intend to free solo that thing, but we did. And I wouldn't recommend it. I just have to say, it's one of those things where you know you're in over your head, but then there's not much turning back. And yeah. I really wouldn't recommend it. I would recommend doing it correctly with some protection and ropes even. And even though it's not super technical, the exposure is pretty darn extreme. But I would like for you to share with us the lightning storm story up there. I mean, what happened?
Yeah, up on the Flatiron, not a ton happened. It was just a lightning storm came through, and I was, you know, definitely uncomfortable about the situation, got really wet, and was pretty over it. But when I think back to my first experience ever being in a lightning storm, and that was in the Alps a few years before that, probably about a year and a half before that, I was terrified. And I was with my friend, and it felt like we were in the middle of a storm cloud, and I could hear trees going down. And it was quite a violent storm, and we were just on the balls of our feet, crouched down low, and making just small talk about our favorite colors or whatever, just to kind of keep our minds off of it. But yeah, it was a scary experience. And like, whenever I see a storm cloud coming now, I always kind of second guess myself and get in my head a little bit. Which is probably a good thing, because it's you know, not a great idea to get stuck in a storm in the mountains.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I have several stories about running from lightning, hiding from lightning, waiting for the storm to pass over. And it's a very strange experience. And I have to, again, say I wouldn't recommend it. But when you go through it, man, it kind of leaves, I don't know. That experience for me has been powerful enough to kind of leave a big question mark in my memory. You know, what if?
And I'm sorry. The chapter on the Flatirons, I think, is really just the start of the reflection in the book. You know, that's the point where I start taking everything that's going on and reflecting back on what has happened before and a lot of the challenges I'd had to overcome. And it was also a point in the book where there was a lot of tension between Zephyr and his girlfriend. Their relationship was definitely falling apart, and they were taking a break from each other right after that. And so Zephyr and I were in similar places, losing people that we really cared a lot about.
Mm. I think that happens a lot around that time period in college too. You know, some people meet in college and then they go the same way. Other people meet in college and go different ways. And that's
it happens. It really does. And it happens all throughout life. People just go separate ways. But when it happens at the time and you're just pissed off and you just want to get away and you're with your best friend who's also going through that, there's a lot of emotional energy.
Yeah, no doubt. So from there, you headed north, right?
Yeah. From there, we headed to Camora, Alberta, which I think was really the first major stop of this trip. It was, we spent a couple weeks there, and yeah, we definitely partied around town a little bit too much and got into the mountains a little bit as well and met a lot of really great friends that I'm still in touch with today there.
So here's a question for you. I think it's really common for people to think about a big trip, especially if they're planning it long enough in advance. And they kind of get a set of expectations. What will it be like, you know? And we like to presuppose what our experiences will be and what the impact will be and all that kind of stuff. But when you actually go on the trip, then life usually deals you a different hand than you expected. But still we learn and we grow. So can you kind of do that for us? You expected something from this trip. That's why you went. And at this point, now you've traveled, oh boy, probably almost 3,000 miles, something like that. And you've had some amazing experiences along the way. But is it starting to pan out to be the trip you expected?
Well, Zephyr and I knew each other very well. And we are very similar people. And we get along super well. But I think what I didn't expect was the tension that would come up between us just by sleeping in the trunk of a car together every day, sharing the small space, only really hanging out with each other every single day as we're traveling. And so these little micro arguments would come up. And I think that contributed to a lot of the anxiety I started to feel throughout this trip. And my book dives into that. And the struggles, the tug of war that we experienced as friends, and how we found that in the wilderness, it is a therapeutic place. It's a great place to run away to, but it also has the potential to push and pull at your emotions.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. I think any time that people are pushed together into close quarters for an extended period of time, the real people come out, you know.
Yeah.
Life gets a little bit tough that you can't really fake it anymore. Who you really are is what starts to show, and learning how to navigate that together. I mean, you already mentioned still your best friend. So did the trip make you guys have an even better friendship?
Yeah, I definitely think so. But here's the thing. It was a roller coaster at the time. I think there were times when I just wanted to strangle Zephyr and Zephyr was pissed off at me. And there were times when I think probably the best thing to do would have been to take some space from each other. But you know, after this trip ended, we took some time away from each other. We stopped talking for probably about 6 months, really, which is, I can't even believe it now, cause I can't go a few days without talking.
Right.
But what I realized, especially writing this book and thinking about what happened between us and reflecting, I realized just how really great of a friend he is. We were both going through some shit. We both had emotions and we were both struggling in different aspects of our lives. And because of that, I think me especially, I had an attitude on that trip. And Zephyr put up with that in a way that I think a lot of friends wouldn't have. And there's not a doubt in my mind that we didn't walk away from that being a really strong duo.
Mm. That's cool stuff. Well, you mentioned climbing in Alberta. Relate to us a story about what you climbed and how that went.
So the favorite mountain I climbed in Alberta is this mountain called Ha Ling, and it's right near the town of Canmore. You can see it from right downtown, and there's a route up it. It's only rated 5.6. It's about 12 pitches, so it's really long, beautiful views, and moderate climbing. And that's kind of what Zephyr and I were in the mood for. And Ha Ling gets exciting because it is kind of hard to find the route. There's a lot of stray gear, and the rock is very crumbly. The entire way, just rock was coming down on us. At one point, I was probably about 20 feet above my last piece of protection. So, a fall at that point would have been very large. And there were quite a few ledges on that route, so it would have been quite bad. And all of a sudden, I hear just everybody below me yell rock at the top of their lungs. And I knew not to look up, and I knew it was about to hit me. And when it did, it just exploded on my helmet, hits both of my shoulders, kind of like almost knocks the wind out of me for a second. I'm just so shaken up with the adrenaline. And I just have my right hand gripping onto this big hold right about my head level. And I'm looking at my hand, just like, don't let go. You can't let go. And it did hurt quite a bit, but kind of pushed through it with the adrenaline, got to the next belay, clipped in, and took a deep breath and just thought, that was awesome. Definitely wasn't awesome, but I loved that climb. It's one of my favorite climbs that I've ever done, just because it's so long, 12 pitches of very moderate climbing. And it's exciting climbing. There's a lot going on. It's not just a walk in the park. It does require quite a bit of thought because the protection is not all there.
Mm. Well, Ari, you've mentioned two kind of what could be life-threatening experiences already, and we're just getting started here. So is this a common theme?
Well, I spent a lot of time in the mountains, and I spent very little time doing day hikes and doing going cragging at like a local rock climbing crag. So I think it's just the reality of spending a lot of time up in the mountains and in places that have higher consequences. But look, there's risk in everything that you do every day. And I think it's, if you look back on your life, you're going to have a lot of close calls just from, walking across the street or, sometimes using power tools and being in the mountains so much, these things happen and they make good stories. And so I tell the stories about the times that I've been in scary situations. And I think what I don't tell enough of are the stories about the times that I've turned around, because I really think that my best skill as an alpine climber is bailing. I bail more times than I can count. And I think it's surprising to people how many times I'll go out and I'll hike for 30 miles to get to the bottom of a climb for like 5 minutes, say, oh, the weather's rolling in, or hey, I'm not feeling it, and just turn around. And deep down it sucks, but at this point I'm not fazed by it. And I remember I went climbing with somebody a few months ago. We were in the North Cascades, and we did just that. We had this long bushwhacky approach. We get there, weather rolls in, can't do the climb. I'm like, okay, let's just turn around, whatever. And she's so bummed. And to me, that's just the reality of alpine climbing.
Yeah, I agree with you, man. And matter of fact, I'll take it the next step. We've interviewed some of the best expedition climbers on the planet. And the really good ones are the ones who've turned around the most. They're the ones that are still alive, by the way, too.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it's not about the summit, it's about the whole experience. And the summit is kind of the bonus, it's the icing on the cake, so to speak. When you do summit and you get to have that experience, that's wonderful, it's glorious, but you can have such a wonderful experience without ever even getting close to the summit.
I couldn't agree more. A lot of people, and especially people who don't participate in this kind of outdoor recreation very frequently, it's hard to differentiate the experience from the summit. And that was a lesson I think my dad learned a couple years ago. He had always wanted to climb Mount Rainier. And a couple years ago, I said, hey, look, why don't you just tag along? We can go climb Mount Rainier. And I brought him on a rope team with a couple friends. And we ended up turning around at like 13,000 feet. So we really weren't too far from the summit, but it was there was a hailstorm going on. It just wasn't a pleasant place to be. And I didn't mind. It was just a normal decision to make. And I think he saw that. He saw, oh, wow, like this is a challenge that goes far beyond my physical ability to climb this mountain, because he totally could have made it to the top, but we couldn't have in that particular storm.
Yeah, exactly. And if you keep going, sometimes you get away with it and sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just not worth it. A buddy and I climbed Mount Princeton this summer. And the reason I bring it up is because that mountain turned us around probably 18 years ago in a snowstorm. In the wintertime, we tried to climb it, and it turned us around. We went back down and had a story to tell. And so we summited together like 18 years later. We looked at the place where we turned around, and it was kind of like, wow, I'm kind of glad we got turned around. Because now that peak has that much more meaning to us, and we have two memories. And, you know, it's kind of like, oh, I beat us once, but we got it the next time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I love telling stories, and I find some of the best stories come from those moments when you turn around and you're not successful. It's really easy to just say, oh, yeah, we climbed it. It went really well. We got to the top. It was beautiful. We turned around.
Right.
But to bring a story to life, there needs to be something that has to be conquered, I think. And the idea of conquering mountains is very nearsighted, because you just can't last very long on a mountain.
Right.
You have to turn around eventually anyways.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, you might make it to the summit and back down again and have some wonderful stories to tell. But if you were to stay up there, you would eventually be in trouble regardless. Right.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, for anybody that's interested in reading my book, it's not a book about success necessarily. There's a lot of failure and a lot of struggle, I think, as far as interpersonal relationships go, as far as my personal mental health and just even getting out into the mountains. There's so many times that we turned around because something went wrong.
Hmm. So kind of a personal question here, but sometimes when people are going through emotionally challenging times, maybe their judgment gets knocked to the side a little bit, or maybe they take bigger risks on purpose because they're looking for, I don't know, they're looking for an experience that's bigger than what they're going through, maybe.
Yeah.
Do you think you were in there somewhere?
I don't think so. And I don't think that's been a pattern in my life. And like many people, I've gone through periods where I've struggled with depression and anxiety. And when I go through those periods in my life, I just don't even want to climb. And that's the biggest struggle for me to overcome, is even wanting to go outside. And so I haven't been in a place where I've pushed myself too far because I wasn't of sound judgment. I find when I do push myself, it's because I'm in a really good headspace and I trust myself. And I'm ready because I'm prepared to do something that I think is a bigger challenge.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
I think that's a good point. You know, for a long time on the Adventure Sports Podcast, we've been talking about how nature can heal. How getting out can bring a lot of health, right? But we have to have sound judgment. And I'm kind of with you, too. I have my off days. When I'm having an off day, I'm more likely to walk away from a challenge than I am to try to take it on. But at the same time, as you did, you know, travel through the United States and Canada and back through Alaska, when you're facing all the challenges of getting along with Zephyr when you're both just stressed out, right? Where did the healing come in?
Yeah, so that's kind of the interesting thing about the name of my book, is because it's really not that straightforward. Nothing gets healed in the book. It's about finding the place where you can heal. And I think that the wilderness is often romanticized as the only answer to struggles. And for many people, it's a huge answer. Getting outside has changed many people's lives. But for me, at least, it wasn't the only answer. It was just the first step in starting to get to know myself, and the first step in learning how to be earnest with myself. And one of the biggest messages from my book is telling people that it's okay to ask for help, because I don't want to give away too much, but that was something that I've always struggled with. I didn't know that it was okay to ask for help when you're depressed. And I thought I just needed to run away from my problems. And honestly, it created this tug of war between my best friend and me, and the wilderness and me, and my perception of the romanticism of the wilderness, just fighting the rawness of the wilderness. And for me, the whole trip, I think, was rather unstable, but I was able to walk away from it prepared to start healing.
Oh, that's cool. So it, instead of providing the healing necessarily, it put you in the place where you were ready for it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think the wilderness does have a powerful position to be able to heal many people who are struggling, but it can't do that for everyone. I don't think it's a fair thing to say that the wilderness alone can solve a lot of these big problems, but it can be one step towards finding a solution, towards growing as a person. And for me, it really wasn't all that I needed. And so I had to go on this long trip to start to get to know myself and understand and reflect on what I had been going through.
All right. Well, what other types of adventures and climbs did you have after Alberta?
We went to the Bugaboos, which is now my favorite place on earth, Bugaboo Provincial Park in British Columbia. It's just this alpine climbing mecca, huge playground with these big granite spires that are coming out of these beautiful glaciers. It's a truly wild place, and some of the best alpine climbing, I think, in North America. And that was the first time Zephyr and I had been there, and we went shoulder season, which means it was earlier than the prime time climbing period in the summer, but right after the too snowy to climb winter. So there was still quite a bit of snow up there, but there weren't a lot of people. And we ended up doing the West Ridge of Pigeon Spire, which is known as one of the best 5.4s in the world. And 5.4 is not a difficult grade. It's easier than any climb you could really find in a climbing gym. But there's something really special about the West Ridge of Pigeon Spire because it flows together beautifully. The rock is in great condition, and the views the whole way are just really spectacular. The British Columbian wilderness, there's just nothing like it. And the exposure you can get on a climb of that rating is really unparalleled. So I loved it, and that's when I fell in love with the Bugaboos. This place is out of this world.
Man, you make me want to go there.
So you should.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. You know, I was thinking about also as you were telling that, you know, a 5.4, and it's like, well, that's a pretty easy climb and all of that. You know, the 14ers in Colorado, you can do a 5.10 pitch if you want to, but you can get up all of them without having to do any technical climbing. There are a couple that have a couple of cruxes you have to get through, but the reality is they're not that technically difficult, but that has little to do with the experience. the experience is what the mountain's trying to tell you, or what you're able to perceive from, you know, the weather and the exertion and how it challenges you personally. Somehow to me, that's different than just technical rock climbing, which I also do.
Yeah. And I'm in the same position. I've been climbing for a while now, and you know, I like to think I'm pretty good at it. And I've climbed in the Bugaboos 5 times since this story happened. But this book is just not about, you know, how great of a rock climber I am. I don't want people to care about that. This book is just about a personal journey. And I think that, you know, it would be silly to focus on the climbs that I did and be like, oh, well, he only climbed a 5.4, he only climbed a 5.6, because that's what I climb in this book, because that's what I was climbing at that period in my life. But that's not the focus of this story. It's just about my experience and the growth I took away. And I find that, you know, that period of my life when I just loved climbing 5.4 because I couldn't get enough of it, because I could get to these wonderful, inaccessible places just by doing a little bit of extra scrambling and bringing a rope and some climbing gear. That's really important to me.
Oh, yeah. I think it's a beautiful place to be, no matter how good you are at being a technical climber. If it's not about the love of the mountains and the love of being out there and interacting with it, then I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think it's something some people get and a lot of people don't. And I have friends that are just diehard gym climbers, and that's awesome. They climb way harder than I ever will. And they don't understand. They're like, oh, well, what'd you do up there? And I say, yeah, I did this route, and that. And they're like, oh, but it was only a 5.8. Like, why'd you bother doing that? And it's like, because it was an awesome climb. Like, you just, you have to do it, and it's an awesome climb. And then I have friends that can climb 5.13 with their hands tied behind their back, and they love the West Ridge of Pigeon Spire. They've done it like 20 times.
There you go.
You got to be there to really feel it, or read the book. And
well, tell you what, when you got to the top of Pigeon Spire, take us there. Describe what the summit experience was like.
Well, the summit was really snowy at the time that we did it, so there wasn't a lot of rock climbing for that last pitch. And the last pitch is usually kind of the quote-unquote crux pitch where the route actually gets its 5.4 rating. So there's a couple more technical moves where the rest of the climb's a lot of scrambling. But that was all covered in snow, so I was just punching my fists into the snow. I placed no protection, get to the top, lay Zephyr up, and we were really happy. And I think, you know, a few days before, we were probably both pretty sad in town. And the weather hadn't been so great, and we'd had a couple fights as friends. But being together on top of that mountain, you just look out, and you can't see anything besides mountains and glaciers. And we were the only two up there, and we brought like a little American flag that Zephyr had stuffed into his pocket. And so we took selfies on the summit, and we were just joking around about bringing our American flag up there. Of course, we were in Canada. And it was just a really happy moment for both of us.
That's fun. And those are the moments we remember too, I think. And they're not always the most amazing thing that ever happened to me in my entire life. Instead, it's like, no, that was a good moment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's actually kind of funny you say that, because I guess I will always remember that moment. It's always in my head, but I don't talk about it too much. I talk about it a little bit in the book because I was forced to sit down and remember everything that happened, and I talked about it now because you asked me about it. But I think the story that I tell most frequently from that trip was when we were walking back across the glacier, Zephyr actually ended up slipping into a little crevasse, and he fell down to his waist. He was totally fine. We got him out, but it was a spooky moment. And so, even though I'll always remember that good moment, I think the first thing that comes to my mind is oftentimes the one that's will keep people more on the edge of their seat.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, people love the stories that are a little bit scarier, like the lightning struck nearby, or I almost fell into this crevasse. So what was that like when he did slip into this thing? Were you guys freaked, or what happened?
Yeah, well, the glacier in the Bugaboos there, some people rope up for it, a lot of people don't. And it's very benign. There's some cracks in it, but they're very small. And like I said, Zephyr plunged his foot into one and he fell to his waist and he wasn't going to fit anymore into that thing. But it was one of those moments where we kind of realized that carelessness is possible and that we just weren't paying attention. He wasn't paying attention to where he was stepping. It was a hole right there. He put his foot right into it. And that was, you know, it's the end of a long day. It happens. But you know, that could have happened on a larger scale. And that's the scary thing. So that was just a small moment of reflection and kind of an example of what I like to call the debrief in outdoor education is at the end of every trip, no matter how well it went, just take a moment and think about maybe micro things that went wrong and certain things that went well and why they went well, and you know, learning how we can be better the next time we head out into the mountains. So that was just really just a little thing that happened, and we laughed about it, and I ended up like just jumping over the crevasse, and I was like, ooh, that was a little spooky, but it was no big deal. But also at the same time, you have to stop and take a deep breath and say to yourself, well, maybe we were being a little too airheaded right there. You know, where we are walking across a glacier.
Lessons learned, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, cool. So after the bugaboos, then what?
Then the weather turned pretty bad in British Columbia. And so we just decided, oh, we'll just keep driving up through Alaska. And that's when we made our way up to Prudhoe Bay. And so we weren't doing a ton of climbing at that point. Just a lot of driving and just being tourists, kind of looking out the window and enjoying wildlife and whatnot. But I think we were pretty wiped emotionally and also physically just from, you know, the climbing we had been doing up to that point and the drama that we had been experiencing as friends. So we were pretty quiet and doing a lot of driving and kind of enjoying the sights along the way. And once we got up to Alaska, to the north coast of Alaska anyways, we were kind of just like, well, this is it. And we turned around and went down to the southeast Alaska, where we spent the rest of the summer.
Well, this, and I know that some of the listeners are saying, well, I want to hear more about Alaska. I mean, you went through central Alaska and then you ended up on the western southern coast of Alaska. Just give us a quick rundown. What was Alaska like for you?
Yeah. A lot of people ask me what I think of Alaska or like, how's Alaska? And Alaska's huge and it's very different everywhere you go. So, there are many places in Alaska that I do not like because they're just kind of boring. And there are many parts of Alaska that are just absolutely incredibly beautiful. And we made a few major stops in particular in Alaska. We stopped in Anchorage to visit a close friend of ours. She's a raft guide. Her name's Emily. And we climbed a little bit in Hatcher Pass, which is just absolutely gorgeous. In Alaska, the rock quality is not very good. It's not a great rock climbing destination. A lot of incredible alpine climbing, but in Hatcher Pass, we actually found some really good rock. It was quite enjoyable, just casual day climbs. And then the next big thing happened in this small little village called McCarthy, Alaska. Our friend Gabe, who we went to college with, he was working as a guide in McCarthy, and he was guiding clients out onto the glacier there, taking them ice climbing in some of the the ice features on the glacier. So Zephyr and I go in to visit him, and actually quite a bit of drama happened there. The biggest thing was that there was an accident with my camp stove, and Zephyr was cooking with it, and he was trying to make coffee. He put the French press attachment in, and he caught up in some banter. He forgot to turn the flame off, which ended up boiling a lot of the grounds into the French press filter, creating a pressure vessel, which proceeded to explode in his face.
Oh, no.
And yeah, so that was not good. And we got him bandaged up. He had some pretty bad burns on his shoulders and not so great burns on his face, and he was very unhappy. I do not blame him. But we got him lathered in aloe, all wrapped up, and Zephyr and I decided, okay, let's just get out of McCarthy. I turn on my car, and I realize my gas light's on. There's no gas station in McCarthy. This place is 60 miles down a dirt road from the nearest town. It's just a little village where these guide companies exist. Our friend Gabe was like, well, maybe I can get you some like chainsaw gas. And I'm like, well, that's not going to work. So we decided, oh, it's 60 miles down dirt road. Maybe my car can make it. And fortunately it did, but talk about white knuckle driving. I've never been so gripped on a steering wheel. Zephyr had his face just pressed up against the air vents, trying to keep it cool. We finally get out of McCarthy. We swing by the gas station. I don't know how my car made it. Fill up. We're starving. So we go into this small little restaurant across the street, and we open the doors, walk in, and just everybody's heads turned towards us because Zephyr's got his face wrapped up like a mummy at this point, and he's got a hat on top of it, just holding all the bandages together. definitely didn't look like a kind of medical job that would have come straight out of hospital. It was definitely some backwoods Alaskan medicine. And so we sat down. The waitress kind of comes over. She's a little unsure of the situation. And Zephyr's like, I need a beer. And so the waitress just turns to him, I'm assuming you're going to need a straw for that. So, there he is sitting, just sipping his beer with a straw through this tiny little hole in his face wrap, and it was really rather pathetic. But the good news is all of his burns healed well. Besides the burns on his shoulders, he does have a little bit of scarring, but that was that was definitely Zephyr's low point in the entire trip.
Man, that does not sound like fun. And you know, it always seems like when one challenging situation pops up, there's going to be more. They're going to try to compound it, you know, like almost running out of gas. And
Yeah. You just keep looking to the next person, like, when's the next thing going to go wrong?
Right. Oh, but you got through it. And so you went back down to southern Alaska. And after that, was it driving all the way back to Boston, or what happened?
So Zephyr grew up in this town called Sitka, Alaska. It's on Baranof Island. It's a neat little community. And so I ended up staying with his family there for about a month. And we ended up going on a 10-day sea kayaking adventure together. And it was really spectacular. And I really hate water sports. And it just my entire life, I've always gotten seasick easily. And I don't like being cold and wet. But Zephyr convinced me to join him on this sea kayaking trip. And we went to a neighboring island in southeast Alaska and were able to camp in all this wilderness area and kind of kayak through these beautiful coves. Saw so much wildlife, lots of whales, tons of sea lions. And it was just absolutely spectacular. The southeast Alaskan coast, it's just hard to explain. You got to go. Mountains just coming right out of the ocean. It's so green and truly wild. You do not see many people. Every once in a while, a fishing boat comes by and you like wave at them like, oh my God, another person. Look at that. So Zephyr and I, about 5 days into this trip, the weather started to turn bad, as you know, this is a common theme in this book, but in southeast Alaska the weather is quite volatile, and we ended up with some pretty large waves that kept us ashore. And at the time we had been camping on this very tiny little island, probably about the size of a football field, and we kind of started to go a little crazy after a few days. We ended up spending a total of 4 days on the island before we were able to get picked up by Zephyr's family friend. And Yeah, Zephyr pretty much sure spent the entire time just trying to keep a fire going, staring into it, and not really saying much. And I just paced laps around the island singing Frank Sinatra to myself. And we made some small talk here and there. We ended up like fighting on the beach physically, we just no holds barred going at each other until I finally tapped out. And it's... It's funny, it was only 4 days on this island, but we were trapped and it was pretty isolating because it was a tiny little island. Clouds kind of sock us in, so you couldn't see much of anything. And it was one of those moments where you're like, I gotta get out of here. Even though I was in one of the most beautiful places on Earth, you know, I just had to get out of there. But it was definitely a challenge of kind of staying above the wild thoughts I was having in my mind at the time, you know, being that isolated in the wilderness. But it was beautiful. It was pretty spectacular. And then once I got back to Sitka from that trip, that's when I decided to drive back to the East Coast, and Zephyr ended up staying there with his family. So I drove back the six and a half days alone back to the Northeast, which was quite the drive to do so, though.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, just driving down British Columbia took as long as driving across the United States.
Of course. Man, it's a big continent when you do it that way. It really is. Well, what are the takeaways from the trip? I mean, I know you learned a lot. And like we already discussed, you know, that our expectations aren't always met. But when you reflect on it, what are some of the things that you'd say, you know what, this is something I'm going to take with me for the rest of my life?
I think... I want people to read this and think about their perception of the wilderness and think about their perception of going outside, and also reflect on a lot of other things they've read about people's experiences in the outdoors. And what is, throughout the book, I question a lot of the classical writers that have lifted the outdoors up on a pedestal. And I have to ask myself, is that harmful to the outdoor community? Does that make the outdoors seem like they are incredibly inaccessible? And at the end of the day, maybe the outdoors is just in our backyard or in the park down the street from where we live. Maybe it's just some dilapidated shack that our friends like to hang out in the woods. It can be found everywhere, and we can learn how to experience it in many different ways. And so it's one thing that, as a writer, that I always kind of struggle with is not telling people how to experience the wilderness, but how I experienced the wilderness.
Sure.
Yeah, and I want people to kind of reflect on their experience and tie it into mine and just think about, you know, is the wilderness this romantic place that we often think about it, or is there also a rawness to it? Is it also a challenge to overcome certain aspects of our own selves when we're in the wilderness? And is it enough to just kind of run away to the wilderness, or do we need to also seek help in other places? For me, at least, being out there, being outside, it's a passion of mine, and it's a place where my mind clears up. And I was able to clear my mind up enough to walk away and say, hey, you know, I'm depressed right now. I need help. And I'm definitely grateful that I was able to do that and able to get that help, because I think a lot of people are scared of that. And it took me many years of being scared to reach out for help, thinking that it was something that made me weak, to finally overcome that fear and be confident enough to get the help I needed. And so this is just kind of a story about how I got there.
Awesome. Well, good for you, man. So the name of the book, again, is Where the Wind Heals, Ari Schneider, and that's Ari Schneider, right?
Yep, you got it.
And so Ari on Instagram, it's Ari_Schneider. Facebook is Ari Joseph Schneider. And how else can people find the book or get more information?
So the book is available on Barnes & Noble's website at Amazon.com and also wherever books are sold. And you know, if you like it, the biggest thing you can do to support this book is ask your local bookstore to carry it. It is distributed globally, so any bookstore should be able to get it in stock. And if you want to reach me, you can send me an email, contact@arijosephschneider.com. And I really look forward to hearing feedback. If anybody out there, anyone listening, reads it, I'd love to hear what you think.
Well, Ari, I, for one, really enjoyed listening to your story about this, and I think that you have a lot of insights that are really meaningful. Even the insight of, well, the woods didn't fix me, but it got me ready. You know, that kind of thing. And I would love to read through this book and kind of, I guess, benefit from some of the hard work that you did. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I hope you find it meaningful. I don't think everybody's going to love it, and that's not why you create a piece of art. But I hope people read it and they think a little bit. If somebody walks away from reading this book and has thought a little bit about the wilderness and their role in it, then my goal has been achieved.
Very cool. Well, again, the book is Where the Wind Heals. And Ari, thanks so much for your time today.
You got it. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, you too, man. And for all the listeners out there, get out there and have some fun. And it might be a trip like this, it might not, but sometimes it takes a trip of this magnitude, I think. It's a life experience that really makes a difference. So until the next show, figure out what your fun is and do it.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Sick of being upsold at gyms? My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.